Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that's in between. If you want to know what's going on in the world on chain, well, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave here, solo dolo, and I'm here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time around, we go not just off chain, but outside of crypto. We have on our first guest that actually doesn't work in the industry. His name's Kyle Chakra. And he is a columnist for The New Yorker. He's the writer of the book Filter World, which is all about algorithms, kind of their evolution, their development, and how they affect our lives every day. And as we all know, crypto is very Twitter-centric. Twitter is the quote-unquote town square, and we are all at the mercy of the algorithm. And that may sound all-encompassing, but all-powerful. But like anything, these are made by people. They have their flaws, they have their benefits, and we talk about both the consequences and the effects of these algorithms in our daily lives. So a lot of great insights. I personally read this book before and I was like, hey, it makes sense to have Kyle on to talk about it and what it has to do with our like lives in crypto and whatnot. So I hope you enjoy this one. Go ahead, pick up the book if you want it. You can figure that out after the episode. But before we get into it, make sure you go ahead, hit that bell button, subscribe. Leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Give us a like. You can follow us on all of our socials on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDave22. And let's get the flywheel spinning. Everybody, welcome back to Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave. And this time around, we're doing something a bit different. This is the first guest that we have that isn't involved in crypto on a day-to-day basis. We are venturing out into the world outside of our little bubble. We have on Kyle Chakra. Did I say that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Kyle Chakra. I always mess up the names. Who is a columnist for The New Yorker and is the author of Filter World: How Algorithms Flatten Culture. And I found this particularly relevant for crypto. And like, as we were saying before, like crypto just lives so online. Like so many people are just like living like day to day, like they're on Twitter, because crypto is such a perception driven industry that you have to like, you know, have your think boy pieces, you have to do your shit posting, this and that. And we don't really like, you know,
it's true. It's like the real time chat room of the internet is what drives all of it.
Exactly. So it's like, we call it like the town square and like everybody's there. And so we'll get into that part. But before we get into it, can you go into like, you know, what inspired you to write Filter World? And like, what are some things you notice about this like algorithm driven society?
Filter World, I think, as an idea, I started thinking about it probably in 2015, 2016. Mm-hmm. And that was like almost a decade ago at this point. Yeah. So it was a while ago. But I was observing a little bit how digital platforms and like the kind of earlier days of social media were also creating this flattening of culture. So I think the first things that I noticed in this realm were Airbnb aesthetics becoming the same all over the world, and like Instagram starting to drive how things looked. So you had this Instagram look that was taking over everything. And I just observed these phenomena over years and years after that. And I just kept thinking about how the internet has maybe not been so good for the quality of culture that we consume on the internet all the time.
Yeah. Do you know how I know you wrote a really good book? It's because not like I just got back from a vacation and I went to the Airbnb and I could not stop thinking about that passage where it's like the same fucking quotes, the same furniture. Like once you see that, once you go in the coffee shops and see the same coffee shop aesthetics, you can't go back.
Totally. That was part of the purpose of writing the book too. I mean, on one level to like exercise it from my own brain. Like when you spend so much time thinking about something, when you write the book, that's like you fully processed it for yourself. But I also wanted other people to have that experience and like think through it with me and kind of notice it in their own world. And then once the book came out, like, I've had great conversations with people about how they do notice it, how it's like changed how they see the world a little bit. And I feel like that was, the goal was accomplished, which was great, a great feeling for me.
Yeah. And there's something on Twitter that, like, I've seen, I'm sure you've seen this guy named Lindy Man.
Yes, of course.
He keeps on like talking about this idea of stuck culture, this idea that like culture has been the better part stagnant since 2005. If you look up from your phone, it seems like with fashion and with music, not much has changed. Like, how much does, you know, Filter World and, you know, this flattening of culture play into like stuck culture, and how do we break that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it is the main cause of stuck culture. Like, for me, that sense of a lack of progress or stagnation or homogenization has basically tracked the rise of the mainstream social internet. Like, if we think back to what was happening in 2005, 2006, like, what change was there? It was the advent of Facebook and Twitter and then Tumblr and Instagram and all of these distribution channels that have taken over how we consume culture. So I think, to me, the feeds that we're on all day are responsible for the flattening of culture and are responsible for kind of dulling our senses for what's interesting, and also limiting how the creators of culture can reach their audiences. Like, the feeds and these digital platforms pressure creators to be less interesting often. So I think this whole ecosystem is responsible for this feeling of stagnation. Though I think sometimes you have to balance that with, you know, not being too rosy about culture in the 80s and 90s, which was also homogenous, but maybe in a different way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, one way you described it as, like, before algorithms, you had people, and people were basically whether they're like a magazine editor or a producer, and they were the ones that decided, like, hey, this is what goes on the television. Hey, this is what goes in the magazine. And we basically replaced that with algorithms. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, like, what is the best way to think about how these algorithms work? And in the beginning of the book, you gave this great example of a Mechanical Turk, where we like often think of like algorithms as this like all knowing, all seeing, like all powerful device. But in actuality, we don't think of, there's a human behind it. There's a human that made the algorithm. So like, what's the best way to think of how algorithms work, and how do they differ from platform to platform?
Yeah. I mean, I think what struck me as I wrote the book was that everyone is talking about the algorithm. Like, we casually reference the algorithm. Like, the algorithm is giving me bad stuff, or the algorithm knows me too well. And I think that hints at our idea that algorithms are this monolithic, like, omnipotent deity that influences our lives day to day. And I think that's wrong. Like, we need to stop thinking like that and stop just saying, oh, the algorithm does this, the algorithm does that. Because, like, the Mechanical Turk that I used as an example is this automaton machine from centuries ago that seemed, it was a robot that looked like it was playing chess and had these gears in a cabinet underneath it. But in reality, it was not the gears making the robot play the chess, but a small man hiding in the cabinet. So in this metaphor, there's always a human in the machine. There's always a little guy making decisions, and it's not just this automated process. So in that metaphor, again, the human part of the algorithm is the Silicon Valley engineers who decide how things work. It's the corporate executives who change the variables and shift how things work in a feed day to day. And I think we have to be aware that those decisions are not just automatically made with our best interests in mind, as we all can hopefully recognize, but they're made with the incentives of the business. They're made to drive more profit. They're meant to shape your attention in different ways that you might not like or want. So I wanted to use the book to like bring back that human element and just make you more aware of how these things work and what structures are behind them.
Yeah, it's like the Mechanical Turk is actually some dude with an MBA that's trying to maximize profit and like trying to like get your attention, like short-term attention, like glued to the screen without like without any thought of like, okay, like, does this have like any taste? Does this have any like
Exactly. I mean, Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify, founder of Spotify, is the perfect example of this, where he speaks of music as content. Like, he has a platform of content that people pay attention to, and he treats music just as another form of content. Like, that is his structure for his business. But as consumers, like, we don't think of music as just some garbage content that we want to consume endlessly. We think of it as a personal, meaningful thing that we want to have emotional experiences with. So I think that's an example of where this mismatch comes in, of like the human making decisions about culture and about algorithms that don't align with the human needs of the user on the other side.
Yeah. And so we have Spotify, which the guy thinks of it as content. We have TikTok, which is like pure attention. Like, how do we get you glued to the screen? And then there's Twitter, there's Facebook. I feel like Twitter's like crack. Facebook's like very slow. And yeah, so like, yeah. How would you like say like each platform has like how their algorithms work, especially now with Twitter and Elon's Twitter?
Yeah, they're all different flavors.
Yeah. Like, there's, it's like different... ice cream shop. Yeah.
Yeah. You choose your kind of brain poisoning flavor of the moment and you drift to different places depending on what you want. So I feel like Twitter X has leaned more into the like thread guy reply getting stuff. Like, replies and conversation are super heavily weighted in the algorithm. So you get a lot of that stuck into your feed. Like, you can see that what gets popular is what generates responses. Whereas, I mean, the Instagram main feed to me, like the post feed, not that anything makes sense anymore. It's like all brands, which I consume very passively. Like, it's all about aggregation, meme accounts, brands, shopping, whatever. So that's a very passive experience, I think. It's not about engaging with your friends or starting conversations. Whereas the Instagram stories part is about interacting with your friends and sparking, you know, message discussions. I think the executives have talked about how more and more conversation happens in DMs rather than comments. And so they've kind of algorithmically shunted the DM inspiring content to the story area and then the passive consumption to the main feed. And threads, I mean, threads is like a different frequency where, you know, to me, it's filled with non-linear or chronological reply provoking garbage, where it's like you're dumped into the middle of a story or an argument or whatever. And you kind of click in just to figure out what it's about. And then you find out it's from like 3 days ago. And so it just, that flavor is like I go to threads and I'm just like, I am so bored and nothing else is giving me what I want. I'm just going to go check out what's on the shelves at threads.
Like, yeah. Then it will pop up on your Instagram and then they'll like say it will be some clickbaity thing. I'm just like, what is this? And they'll like usually do it by location or they'll do it by interest.
For sure.
Yeah, and stories is I think stories is probably my favorite social media feature. For me, I love posting stories. I love posting memes because they it's fun to see how people react to them, and then like responding to people's stories. And like, it's a great way to keep in touch with people. It's low key the best dating app. Like, stories are I think they really knocked it out of the park. And it was originally not even theirs. It was originally Snapchat's. And they just completely swallowed it.
Right. I mean, it makes me think about how different aspects of these products are designed for different purposes. Like, I think a decade ago or even like 6 or 8 years ago, you kind of knew what to do with each part of an app. Like, you knew that Instagram was going to give you cool imagery and interesting like cultural accounts. You knew that Twitter was going to give you the latest news. But now all of those purposes have kind of been jumbled up. And I think stories remains the kind of most real-time, actual relationship-driven, like, conversation-starting function of social media in a way that you can comprehend. Whereas, like, there's tons of conversation and like interesting argument on X, but it's completely incoherent. Like you have no grasp of it.
And then X is becoming a video app. Like they're trying to promote. Yeah. And
I mean, this is another like algorithmic effect, I think, is that every platform becomes a space for everything all the time. Like you can't just do images. You can't just do text. You can't even just do videos. Like you have to do video and e-commerce and diary entries and audio clips and just like everything at once. Like that in itself to me is a form of flattening, because you're erasing the unique purpose of an app and you're just like, okay, this is just another garbage chute for all kinds of stuff.
And then with TikTok in particular, I feel like TikTok is the end result of like the most optimized algorithm. And can you go into like your thoughts on the TikTok algorithm a bit?
For sure. I mean, I think most algorithms deal with a few principal variables, like, you know, whether it's clicks or faves or comments or whatever. And TikTok, I think, innovated by saying, we don't care who you want to follow. We don't care like who you think you want to see. We are going to just show you what you engage with. Like when you are on TikTok, you are giving constant signs to the recommendation algorithm about what you're paying attention to and how you're interacting with it. So it doesn't matter if you don't click a button, hit like or comment or whatever. The app can just see how long you've paid attention to the video and then give you more of that kind of content. So I think it's just TikTok, what it did was just maximize for passive engagement, where no matter how interested you are, like what you pay attention to is always being measured by the app, and it's doubling down on that.
Yeah. And I feel like one consequence of this, whether it's TikTok, whether it's Netflix, it has made culture very ephemeral. And you're basically consuming what interests you at the time, what's like recommended to you. And then you kind of forget about it like it's a fever dream. And that's probably big. Like, it's like, oh, like what happened? Like, at one point in the book, you mentioned like Emily in Paris, which is like this book. I mean, which is this show on Netflix about this like girl who becomes an American girl, becomes an influencer in Paris. And you like watch the show quite passively. And then when it doesn't really leave an effect on you. So when the show ends, you kind of just like go on with your life. And it has like, it doesn't have that same artistic effect where like it's like something like The Sopranos or Sex in the City, where like that like sticks with you and like in the meme and like that spawns all these memes that you see on Instagram and whatnot. And so like I guess like what are your thoughts on like the ephemeral nature of content now?
And like how I think that things is, are more ephemeral. Like fever dream is the perfect description for so many things that you experience online now, because you dive into a well of content, or you like go down a rabbit hole and you get so obsessed with it for like a few hours or a few days, and then it's gone forever. Like you don't know how you got there. You can't get back. You might have saturated yourself with it and got bored of it anyway. And things then pass from your mind. And I think, I mean, that happens because the feeds need constant novelty to recommend to you to keep your deep engagement. Like, I think TikTok works this way the most, where it kind of sinks you into one specific niche of content and just serves it to you until you get bored of it. Like right now, my feed is a ton of surfing videos, particularly like learning how to surf or like, you know, beginner whatever chill videos. And I love it. I'm like having a great time watching it, but I know it'll drift away in a week or two and I won't have followed that many people, like, and that'll just be over. Like the surfing 2 weeks will be over. Maybe TikTok, like the omnipotent algorithm, will bring it back to me in a month or two and be like, are you still interested in this? But as it stands, I'm just passively absorbing it without learning more, without diving so much deeper. I think that like the in-depth quality is also ephemeral in a way. Like, you know, I think in slower eras of culture, there is more opportunity to really make something a part of yourself, to really identify with something that you are consuming, like something like punk music
or Star Wars.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can you can make that your personality in a way, and like get really into it and learn everything and understand it and engage with it on a long-term basis. But that just doesn't seem to be as much the case now. You know, with feeds delivering you so much different content and with the ephemerality of things, it's like discourages you from engaging that deeply.
So it's basically the speed at which the content is consumed is having an effect on like whether you incorporate it in your personality. And also not just that, but because the algorithmic feeds are only tailored to you, whereas before it was like, oh, it was mass culture. So something was in the movies and everybody saw it. I was like, oh, something was on TV and everybody saw it. And you had these stars, which like everyone knew their name. But nowadays, like you have influencers that are really big with like a certain segment of the population, but then no one knows them outside.
Totally.
Crypto Twitter's, go ahead.
No, I mean, crypto Twitter is definitely like that. See, I mean, crypto in general is like a world unto itself that if you are not involved in it, I mean, one, you might think it's stupid, and two, you have no idea who is authoritative or what's going on.
That's a huge problem, too.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, that idea of fame is really interesting, too, because like what makes something famous? It's like the number of people who understand a thing or who can recognize it or pay attention. And I think in decades past, we did have that monoculture more. Like, I think this falls under the idea of monoculture, where millions of people are experiencing the same things. They have this coming together over Star Wars or whatever. And there's this collective conversation where everyone is acknowledging the same cultural item.
Yeah.
And I think that happens. It's harder to do that now because all of our feeds are so different. Like, we don't know which influencer you pay attention to, which versus the one I pay attention to. Like, they might have millions of followers, but there's no public collective, like, shared understanding of that fame.
Yeah. I feel like people like Drake or Taylor Swift, they came out at the perfect time. And if they were around today, there's no way they would be able to get to the level of fame and recognition, because they were the last ones before the algorithmic recommended fees. And not only that, but they were able to ride the wave of the algorithmic recommended fees. Mm-hmm. I mean, feeds. Like, I remember seeing something about Drake when one of his albums came out a few years ago. It was just plastered all over Spotify. You cannot get away from it.
I think that's really true. I mean, you think about what makes them special too, and it's like they had these personas that were really relatable and people could connect with them and find them aspirational, and people like followed the journey of Drake from, you know, underdog to super famous guy. Like, same thing with Taylor Swift in a way. And they, like, their personalities scaled up basically to reach the size of the internet. And I think that really worked out for them. But then when you see the new crop of celebrities coming up, it's kind of a different flavor.
It's way different. I feel like you did see taste in the 2010s, like the last bastion of it. It may have not have been as like wide as like the mass culture, mass consumption of before, but it wasn't as individualized as TikTok culture. It was like, you saw on YouTube, I remember in high school, seeing like Mac Miller music videos, and everybody like who my age was like all about those music videos. And then you had like the SoundCloud rap era, which was like the last tastemaker era of rap music, I think. And then, and even to this day, whenever I meet someone that's like was into that era, it was like we kind of have this connection and bond. And then, but like once TikTok came, it completely destroyed that.
It's like the, I mean, it's hints at this argument that I have, I think, which is that different kinds of platforms create different kinds of culture. Like, there was a SoundCloud era of rap, and that was like a scene and a community and an art form and a genre that emerged around that. Tumblr was a real era of like artistic aesthetics and like visual culture. That then kind of got erased as Tumblr went away. Like, that mode of interaction no longer exists. So TikTok is like, you've paved the forests for the parking lot. You know, it's like,
exactly.
Like, TikTok is this one generic space where people are yelling at you to buy stuff constantly. And that's not good for the generation of interesting culture, because it's like too fast, too ephemeral, too crowded, too flattened, because you have to act a very specific way to break through in that space.
And you know that these things had an effect because people are nostalgic about it. People are so nostalgic about Tumblr. You still see it all the time. People are nostalgic about the SoundCloud rap era or whatnot. That's how you know, like, a piece of culture has had an effect.
It's a good point. Yeah, I think people look back fondly on those times because it was slower, because it felt more comprehensible. Yeah. And I think you have, like, smaller scenes within TikTok. Like, you know, it's like, I never want to make the argument that everything is bad, you know, but it's all about how you use it. So for me, cooking culture has been really successful on TikTok because it enables really interesting small scale creators to just like do stuff in their kitchens. And I watch it and I'm super inspired to go try it out for myself. Like, it's not so much cult of personality or like influencer stuff as just here is the cool food stuff that I'm doing right now. And it feels very shared and collective. So for a genre like that, it works well on TikTok for, and you know, you the reasons.
You also mentioned BookTok in your book. Like,
Like certain kinds of books have become really, really, really popular on TikTok, and certain kinds of influencers have become popular for recommending books. And I think it's great whenever people read more books. Like, please go read more, whatever books you want. But it does prioritize certain genres, right? Like, you can tell what is a TikTok book, and it's often, you know, highly narrative, very emotional, like often romantic, you know, relatable kind of adolescent, early adult stories. And that's also the demographic of the platform. So it's not a bad thing per se, but it, like, the ubiquity of TikTok books shows how there's a homogenous culture that comes out of TikTok, because once there's an image of the TikTok book that works, publishers are just going to chase that and like spit out, you know, a dozen more fairy tale, erotica, fantasy series. You know? It's like, once you find the solution, everyone copies it until it gets so boring that no one likes it anymore.
Yeah. It's basically like, oh, the algorithm has deemed this as what it will show. And then everybody just fits the algorithm.
Exactly. Yeah. I think these feeds create an image of what's popular and what works. And that incentivizes people to copy that. I mean, it's down to video podcasts. Like literally. It's not that everyone wants to watch us talk on microphones. It's that videos travel farther and faster online than just pure audio does. The platforms are better adapted for video. So suddenly everyone's making highly edited video clips of their podcasts. Like, that's the platform structure dictates the shape of the culture, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And on Twitter, in particular with crypto Twitter, what I've noticed is like, there'll be like certain trends of like words or like metas that become popular. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, for I work in BD in my day-to-day job. And for like a second, like crypto BD, like the meme of BD was the meme. So if you tweeted BD, like that was like what brought, where like came up to the meme. And like everyone just like made these different like jokes about BD and this and that. And that's what like came up to the feed. And so like, and then there's like other things like, oh, like this certain event happened and everybody tweets about it. Or like, oh, like, and what's becomes a problem is if there's like fake news, and then like that becomes like the thing that gets to the top. And so like the thing with like Twitter, it's like, oh, well, like find this like one thing and then like bring it to the top.
Yeah, you hustle as hard as you can for your meme or whatever, and you ride the wave and then watch as other people jump into it in order to get some of that juice.
But like, what's interesting is like, as like a creator or like a personality on Twitter, you could go like 100% in the like being subservient to the algorithm and like trying to get followers and clicks and views and all that. But if you do that too much, you kind of like lose your voice and you lose your taste. And then you're like, and then you realize that your followers are just like not very high quality. And at the end of the day, you're just like, you stop getting views if you stop playing the game.
So, it's a hard balance to strike because you want to have original thoughts and you want to bring something new to the table.
You want
to
have
but
taste.
You also want to get heard. Yeah. Like you want to have taste in your ideas and what you find relevant or interesting.
Yeah.
And you want to join the collective conversation and like be heard at all. So you have to like do both of those things in order to survive in the algorithmic ecosystem.
Yeah. And there's this constant kind of tug of war and battle between taste and recommendations. Like taste is something you mentioned that's like ephemeral. I mean, ineffable. It's ineffable. It's abstract. You can't really grasp it. It's not something you may like the person may like in the moment, but they'll let it marinate and it's something that sticks with them. Meanwhile, with recommendations by the algorithm, that's something you like in the moment and grabs your attention. But instead of being ineffable, it's ephemeral, then it's gone. Is there a way like a future algorithm could take into account taste more? Or is that impossible because recommendations are based on data, but taste is like not based on data? There's no data at all in taste. Yeah.
It is really interesting. Like recommendations versus taste is so interesting because recommendations, I suppose, are more algorithmic. Like we talk about algorithmic recommendations. And then taste is the human, the non-algorithmic, the non-automated, the non-data. Yeah. It's like your intuitive leap, your like realization of something new and different. And so those two are in conflict a lot of the time. But I think, I mean, the structure of the feeds is rewarding engagement above all, like ephemeral engagement that's really strong, really fast, and then fades away. Whereas taste, as you were saying, is this longer term investment. So I think algorithmic feeds could be much better than they are. Like they could be more interactive. We could tell them more what we're interested in. We could say like, don't bring me quite so much engagement bait. Like I want to dial down the relatability factor here. And they could just be slower and less crowded. And I think all of those things would better reward taste. Though it's like going back to the earlier internet culture, Twitter was at its best when it was not so algorithmic. Like the linear, for a long time, the chronological feed was all that existed. And that's what made Twitter the source of what is happening this second in the world. And that's like gone. Same thing with Tumblr. Like Tumblr has long been pretty much linear, not driven by recommendations. And that helped people display their taste and develop these long-term fascinations. So I kind of wonder if it's like no algorithm is actually better than any kind of recommendation algorithm, or at least you know, I find it interesting where, you know, Threads has the algorithmic feed and then the linear feed and they're not very intermingled.
So does Twitter.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing that's relatively new and we're still figuring out how to deal with that. But what I think the kind of problem is that a good linear feed takes a really long time to develop. I had to be on Twitter from 2008, you know, for 8 years to get like a really great linear feed. And that is not the case anymore. Like we don't have that time to invest in something because we don't know how long it'll last.
And also with the algorithms, it's or with the UI of platforms, if something changes, like you mentioned with Spotify, they changed this one feature and all your playlists are just gone, and I think or something like that. And I think that you gave a great metaphor of like these platforms are really just sandcastles, and at any moment a wave can come in and just completely mess up the sandcastle and you have to build a new one.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter, most of all, I mean, under Elon Musk, it's like changed so much. And a lot of people have found their following and their audience and their interests kind of decimated by those changes. Like it's been good for some communities. And I think crypto Twitter has done just fine. But the ephemerality of it means that you can't trust that what you make today will still be there in a year or two. And that disincentivizes you from putting too much effort into it. Like you don't want to put all your best ideas there. You don't want to develop an audience that could go away. And so I do see that leading people toward less algorithmic spaces like newsletters or even a Discord chat is less algorithmic than Twitter.
I was about to say Telegram. I feel like Telegram has really come out as like one of the best non-algorithmic platforms because that, I mean, yeah, you have group chats and everything, but now you have like subscriber channels. And so people like, I started like my own subscriber channel and like that comes up whenever I write something.
Yeah, I think it's really like, to me, the golden rule is like the more direct connection between people, like the less mediated these interactions are by algorithms and recommendations and even advertising, the better it is. Like the better output of that community or interaction will be. So you get like really healthy interactions on a Substack newsletter or on a niche Telegram channel. Like those are meaningful communities. Whereas Twitter is kind of like, it's a cafeteria food fight or something. Like you it's not healthy. It's powerful, but it's not healthy. And it's not like a long-term thing.
Yeah. And something you mentioned in the book, you talked about the role of government and regulation, especially early on in the internet, like basically the rules of engagement were decided in 1996, where like, oh, platforms aren't publishers. So that they're like chill to like, be lenient.
For sure.
But like now, like, but back then algorithms weren't, I mean, they were a thing, but their effects and consequences really were not understood to its fullest extent. Like now that we fully understand these algorithms, and I feel like they're the equivalent to cigarettes. I'm literally wearing a cigarette shirt for that reason. Like, is there like some justification for there to be, you know, for government to like step in and make rules about how these algorithms should work, whether it's like for us, but especially whether it's for like children whose brains are still developing and like they're really vulnerable to being manipulated by these algorithms?
Yeah. I mean, it's wild to me that we regulate cable television much more than we regulate social media. And like cable television, not everyone can just put themselves on cable television, whereas the internet is like cable television for everyone at once all the time.
Yeah. And so, there's some benefit to that for sure.
Yeah. Like the lack of gatekeepers is really powerful and it's very exciting, but at the same time, it's really dangerous. And like you're able to go too far very often. So I think there's a lot of possibilities for regulation. Like I think that social networks are not responsible enough for what's on their platform. Like this law, Section 230, that allows social networks to not be publishers and to not take responsibility for what's on their platform, that preceded this era in which social networks are less neutral than ever. Like social networks are making more decisions about how we see things and how we access them and what gets promoted. So I think like social networks have kind of pushed that law as far as it can go. And now we need something new because they are making editorial decisions. They are influencing content that exists on them. And I think like things are gradually changing, not so much in the US, but the European Union is doing really good work just in terms of forcing tech companies to have some sort of responsibility for their users' data and for not, you know, exploiting our attention as much.
Oh, what are they doing in Europe?
There are two main law packages that are called the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act. And the DSA is more about individual users' rights and allowing you to opt out of data collection and opt out of recommendations entirely, which I think will be really powerful. So imagine just turning off all recommendations on Instagram forever.
That reminds me of like Apple, how they let you opt out of like being tracked. Mm-hmm. And that's completely destroyed one of Facebook's main revenue drivers.
Exactly. Like erased billions of dollars of revenue. And that was
crazy.
That was kind of an after effect of these EU laws coming into effect. Like Apple didn't have to do that in the US, but it did. And so suddenly like Facebook's revenue is down. And that, I think, is more the future that we're going to experience. It's these like competing ways of controlling your data and governments acting more to regulate how we use the platforms. I mean, you see right now, Brazil has banned X. Like people in Brazil cannot use
the platform. That's crazy.
Wait, and that's new. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, why did they ban X?
As far as I know, it's about, well, in a literal sense, I don't know about the, you know, conspiracy theories or whatever, but in a literal sense, it's because Elon Musk refused to designate a legal representative of the platform in the country. So, he's like, the government is trying to regulate the platform, and X is like, well, we don't have anyone there. Like, we have no legal thing there. So what are you going to do? And so what the government is like, cool, we're just going to ban you. Like, we're going to erase the ability for Brazilians to use this platform, which is a huge move. That's very dramatic. So I think we'll see more of that kinds of action. That people have realized these platforms are dangerous and they are vulnerable. Like, you can do that.
And like two trends I feel like you're seeing are these platforms being more kind of kingdoms or fiefdoms for powerful individuals, whether it's like Elon Musk, Twitter, Trump, Truth Social, Zuck, Threads, YouTube's still YouTube. But you know what I mean? And that's one trend. And another trend is like the internet becoming more closed. And for so sure. whether you see like, you know, Twitter, Brazil, I mean, they were talking about banning TikTok in the US for so long. I think TikTok is banned in India. China has had a closed internet for a while. So like, I wonder if this era of like a free and open global internet is over, and it's going to partially be caused by these like fiefdoms popping up.
Yeah, I think so. It's like the balkanization of the internet. Like, we're moving into an era of more closed spaces that don't interconnect so much. And we're experiencing the internet in really different ways, depending on where we are.
So siloed. Yeah.
Yeah. People are still like, fame still transcends those barriers right now. Like, Taylor Swift is still insanely famous. Mr. Beast, you know, did really well on YouTube. So I think there's some transcendence of those barriers, but I think increasingly we'll see, you know, things splitting up and moving away from that utopian idea of the same internet everywhere on the planet.
Yeah. And another thing that you said earlier in the interview that I can't get out of my head is the best feed is one of personal connection and one that's linear. And at the end of the day, if we just like go back full circle back to where we started with linear feeds, we'll probably be like better off as a society and culture may get out of this stuck phase that it's in.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can't disconnect the flaws of the platforms from the flaws in culture that we see right now. And that's not just about algorithmic recommendations or feeds. It's about essentially the economic function of the internet. So right now, still the main business model of the internet is advertising. And that creates a lot of really bad incentives for the creators of content, as we've seen, you know, in all sorts of cases. So this move toward more subscriptions and more private communities, I think, is really good. Like, that is kind of the more linear version of the internet, the more direct version of the internet that we had before and we kind of lost for a while.
Yeah, I agree. I guess the only exception to that is Twitter, because there's subscription now and there's still an algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if Twitter is almost like, it's like we're all subscribing to Elon Musk's Patreon or something.
That's basically what Twitter is now. It's Elon Musk land.
Elon Musk Telegram channel, except it's, you know, a billion users or whatever. Yeah, but I see more and more people creating their own spaces and like developing communities and connecting with audiences who understand them. And that's much harder to scale up. It's not a broadcast system, and you have to slowly grow these things. But in the end, it's healthier because people know what you're talking about. Like, on Twitter, you're so liable, or X, you're so liable to be misunderstood, to be shouted down, to be like harassed. Whereas in your own spaces, whether in a Discord channel or like your Substack or whatever, people know what you're trying to do. Like, they know when you're joking. They know when you're being ironic. They know the context of what you're doing. And that's better for anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing I was going to ask was, like, with AI coming out, and AI's like super algorithm, like, I feel like it may create even more stuck culture than before. I guess, like, what are your thoughts on like how, like, if these platforms are going to incorporate AI if they haven't already in their recommendations and like what that means.
Yeah. I mean, it's we're in a new era.
A new era. Yeah.
Circa late 2022 or whatever. My gut theory has always been that algorithmic feeds and recommendations pressure people to be generic. Like they pressure all YouTube creators to use the same kinds of thumbnails. They pressure all influencers to like talk the same on TikTok, because the incentive is the more generic you are, the more promotion you get.
The more the wider appeal you have,
exactly,
and you can be promoted.
Yeah. So you're flattening yourself. But then in the generative AI era, it's like pre-flattens.
It's like it's even worse.
Yeah, the AI will not spit out anything original. It'll just follow literally the average, like literally what the most people say a thing is. That's what the AI will.
It's like AI has zero taste whatsoever. It's like the opposite of it.
Yeah. And I don't think like generative AI can be a really interesting tool. And I know a lot of visual artists who do cool experiments with it and have gone places using it as a tool. But so many people are mistaking just using a generative input thing for creativity. Like the point is not that you can make an image. It's like, what do you do with that image? How do you make a film out of AI generated clips? Or I've been really interested in the AI generated music and voices because it's fascinating. Like
that is,
that is like cool. Interesting that anyone can make a Drake song. Or, you know,
or a SpongeBob song that sings like classic rock or something.
Right. Like that is super interesting because it's not just a generic output. It's like someone had to have the idea.
Somebody had to have taste.
Yes. Yeah. To be like, what if SpongeBob sang this song? So, yeah, I feel like there's space for it to be more than just a joke and a one liner. But I think if you are just using an AI tool and taking its output as something artistic, you're probably not making very good art.
If you use it as like a proper tool to do powerful things, like using what you know already and like your taste and everything that like you've already existed in the context of to bring out this like new novel thing. Yeah. Now Kamala's like statement like means so much more, like existing in the AI cannot exist in the context because it's just there. It's just like a tool.
Meanwhile, I mean, about ephemeral.
Ephemeral,
like the ephemerality of a given AI output is like 0 seconds.
It's literally. Like,
it might as well be gone the second that it gets output because it has no inherent meaning unless you expand upon it, you make it into something else, you adapt it. I mean, I think I'm also not convinced AI tools are that applicable to billions of people. Like I think social networks were more powerful for more people than ChatGPT ever will be.
I agree.
So I don't know if we're gonna see this like total revolution in the next decade. If only because it's always more interesting to connect to another human than to connect to a robot. Like it's in almost every case, like we are going to prefer talking to our actual human friends to interacting with like an AI app, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so too. I was going to say one more thing about kind of my experiences as a creator. I've been talking about Twitter a lot, but YouTube in particular, especially with this podcast and with all the clips we come out with, I experience like if you don't go with the flattening of culture, like how you kind of get punished by it. Because this is technically, this is more often than not a crypto podcast. And it actually goes really deep into the subject matter. So it's not really for the most wide appeal. And with crypto content in particular on YouTube, what it like recommends to people are like airdrops or like this token pump or like get or like anything that like induces FOMO. That is the content that gets recommended on YouTube. Meanwhile, these like deeper podcasts, more often than not, kind of get like shoved into the backside. And like, although like people, like, although this podcast, I'll say like has taste and people really appreciate like what this podcast has come out with in the past, it's not for like the mass appeal where like, when the thing is with like those people that are like the mass appeal, they're usually like watching it and then forgetting about it. They don't really have an emotional connection with the creator. Meanwhile, with like podcasts like this and other crypto podcasts I've seen, like there is an emotional connection and there is like something like, oh, I am getting something of value out of this podcast. Granted, like, I think there's like other small things, not just content. Maybe I could like improve the thumbnails or like improve like, you know, certain
the delivery
or like this and that. But like, it's interesting how like, if you don't like play the game, then you get punished. Then that's what the algorithm mocks me does. It doesn't really reward people's like taste. It really rewards like whatever like the algorithm like wants because of more advertisements and stuff.
Engagement baiting, essentially, any space is what will work. But you're totally right that like the output of that or the result of that is more ephemeral and less meaningful.
Content.
Like what builds long-term value is the connection with the person behind the microphone, hopefully. Like people who listen to your podcast connect with you and they want to know what else you're thinking about. Or people who read my newsletter, you know, might have wanted to read my book more than a random person because they understand where I'm coming from. So I think like that's the future, increasingly the future of the internet is like these smaller scale creators and individuals that can connect with other people. It's just a matter of how you manage that connection. Like, are you a random face on TikTok or are you a small community on Patreon or Substack? Like what game do you want to play? Or are you playing all of them at once and like getting your random attention from TikTok, driving it down to your Patreon. Newsletter or whatever? Yeah.
And you see that on YouTube, like there's these YouTube channels that like they banded together where they're like, okay, we understand like YouTube like has a certain game and we have to like use this as a funnel, but then they have their own private video platform where people like pay for like the membership and they get like much more of the content they want, like that's provided by their taste.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's good. Like that funnel is not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
But it's like, the funnel should work for everyone. It should work for us random viewers and it should work for the creator at the end of that equation. And right now I think the random viewer relationship is quite bad. Like TikTok does not necessarily encourage you to go down the rabbit hole with someone or, you know, click through to their profile or find their Patreon or whatever.
Especially Twitter, where it like really punishes links or really punishes anything off the platform.
Yeah. Like the incentive there is to stay within the platform and to theoretically make more money for Twitter. And I think that's the problem. So it's like right now it feels like a Wild West in a way where you're just grabbing as many people to your little pod of space as you can before the, you know, helicopters leave or whatever, before the juice runs out.
And I have one last question before we wrap up, two last questions, but like, how can people, I mean, we can't escape this algorithm driven society. We have to live with it. So like, how can people better balance living in it and balancing novelty novelty and culture and taste with like content and recommendations in their life?
Yeah. I mean, everything has to exist in a balance. Like I kind of, by the end of this book, I was thinking of our cultural diets, kind of like the food pyramid or something.
Yeah.
Like you, sure, at the bottom, at like the junk food level, you have random stuff on TikTok, but you also want to develop like the higher levels of that. You want to know what books you're reading, know which writers you like, have a relationship with the musicians you follow, like know an interesting DJ who posts mixes on SoundCloud. Like you want your healthy, intentional vegetables as well as your junk food. And I think it's like, we can discover all we want online. Like the discovery is totally possible in all of these ecosystems. But again, what matters is what you do after that. Like, don't just follow someone on TikTok. Figure out how they make money, figure out how they do what they do.
Have a well-balanced diet, information diet. Yeah.
And support the people who you like. Know if there's a curator you like, you know, go to their Patreon or like subscribe to a newsletter or watch their podcasts on YouTube or just like anything but the kind of passive ambient attention that's rewarded by TikTok. Basically, and stuff.
Be active with the ones you actually support. Yeah, like I probably my favorite YouTube, one of my favorite YouTube channels, because I use YouTube Music for music as well, are these like lo-fi funk channels like Ryan Celsius, Smooth Sounds, where like, yeah, the algorithm recommended them to me, but they're actually tastemakers on their own channel. And I find so much novel music because it's like a human that's deciding like, okay, like this is like the hot new song. And they're, I couldn't recommend them enough, but
yeah, like we all need those lists in our heads.
You all need those like, curators.
Here's the 5 to 10 people who I really care about and I support them directly. And I think if we could all do that, then we'd have a much healthier ecosystem at the end of it.
And maybe we'll finally get out of stuck culture, but we'll,
I think
we'll
so. See. Yeah. Yeah. Slowly, slowly.
Yeah. And so Kyle, but before we end this, can you, where can people find you online?
I'm still on Twitter, unfortunately, where I'm just like doing my own shit posting. So that's at Chayka K. It's like last name, first initial. My website is kylechayka.com. I should update it more. I'm on Instagram. I don't post TikToks yet. You know, I feel like Instagram stories is the most fun, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a bad time to be online, but you just have to look harder.
You just have to learn how to deal with the ocean that we're in.
Yes, exactly. And you should buy Filter World, the book, because it'll help you understand. Understand the ecosystem more.
Yeah. Kyle, thanks so much for coming on. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everybody, for watching this episode of Flywheel with Kyle Chayka, who was the author of Filter World. I really enjoyed this episode, especially from reading the book. Algorithms are something that are part of our daily lives, and we don't really think about them. And if we do, we think about them as this all-encompassing, all-powerful force. And it was just nice to get some insight and kind of break down like how these different forces actually work and like what we can actually do to create a better world. And so I hope y'all enjoyed this one. If you want to see more content like this, maybe people that are adjacent to crypto, adjacent to the world that we're in, but not exactly in crypto, make sure you go ahead, leave a comment below. Let me know what you think. Go ahead, give us a like, subscribe, hit that bell button. If you're on YouTube, make sure if you're on Twitter, go ahead, give us a like, give us a repost, give us a follow there. On our other socials, make sure you follow us at Flywheel DeFi on TikTok, Telegram, and of course, Twitter. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at DeFiDay22. And we'll see you next week. Peace. Everything said in this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not an investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.